is 101. So I want a 101 or 801, wherever you may be. So I want to welcome everybody. Part three, Dr. Lasker talking, does God talk to humans? So I know humans talk to humans and we're in the image of God. But other than that, I have nothing else to say on the topic and we'll let our expert, Dr. Lasker, continue. Vakasha.
Okay. Thank you very much, Rabbi Kelman. Again, I'm glad to be able that I'm back. I'm glad I can hear you and that you can hear me. The first session 2 weeks ago, I talked about how Jewish thinkers try to solve some of the problems that arise when people use their reason, as expressed in philosophy or science, to understand religious beliefs, and about how there's an attempt to show that Judaism, despite its claims of, you might say, the supernatural or the unnatural, can come to some conclusions about or compromises with reason. Last week I showed how it worked coming in when dealing with the existence of God and the creation of the world. Today I wanted to talk about his revelation and whether God talks to humans and whether God can give a law to humans. Now we know that the Torah teaches us that that God on Mount Sinai revealed Torah, according to Rabbinic Judaism, two Torahs, and written one in an oral law. The commandments in the Torah are to be observed by Jewish people, and God sets out exactly what should be done, how Jews should act, how the people of Israel should act. So if you look at it from point of view of reason or philosophy, there are certain problems. And one of the problems is, can God talk to humans altogether? Now, there's some people who say, and through the history have said, well, God is too exalted. God is too transcendent. God is too removed from the world to be able to talk to humans. And then there are other people who said, well, humans don't need God to talk to them. Humans can take care of themselves. You have human laws. Humans have reason. They can come up with law code. They don't need religion. They don't need a God to talk to them. So the philosophical questions really have to do about the nature of God. God, as mentioned last week, was considered to be immutable, unchanging. So just as why would God one day get up and say, oh, I'm bored, I want to give a world, I want to make a world, why would he on another day get up and say, well, I see the world, but you know, I'm going to choose these particular people, one obscure tribe living in the Middle East, and I'm going to give them a law code, and I'm going to do all kinds of miracles for them, and I'm going to take care of them and watch over them. So can God, who's immutable, can God suddenly give a Torah? Can God suddenly reveal himself or herself to the prophets? Another problem is that if you think about the description of the, what we call the theophany, the revelation of God on Mount Sinai, and those of you who were in synagogue on Shabbat heard this being read, the people heard voices. Actually, it says they saw the voices, but there people heard God talk. They saw what looked like manifestations of God. Well, again, last week we discussed how God is incorporeal without a body. And suddenly God is talking. Suddenly God is able to see God. And so, how is this possible? And if we have people who are prophets to whom God talks, how do you become a prophet? How do we know that a prophet is a legitimate? Someone goes up and says, God talked to me. Do we necessarily accept it? If you go on the streets of any major city in the world, I'm sure you can find people with signs or a billboard saying, God told me to tell you this and this. And how many of them do we accept? Repent because the end is near. I often say that to my students getting toward the end of the semester, but this is not necessarily something that we would find a person on the street and say, oh yes, that person must be a prophet. Why is there no prophecy today? If prophecy is possible, if God talked to people in the past, why does God talk to people now? And why the Torah? What's special about the five books of Moses? what's special about the Bible, that God would give those particular laws, and to a particular people, the people of Israel, the Jews. What about other religions? So I have all kinds of questions which arise, which the philosophers try to solve or answer. And what I want to do today is go through some of the answers that they came up with. And specifically, I'll be talking mostly about Rabbi Judah Halevi. Remember, he died in 1141. And Maimonides, who was born in 1138. So, in other words, two generations, let's say, after Judah Halevi. Now, let me start with Halevi, who basically says, I know that God can talk to humans, and I know there can be revelation, and I know there can be prophecy, because there it says it in the Torah, and the Torah was witnessed by 600,000 witnesses, and these 600,000 witnesses told their children, told their children, told their children until it came to me. We have a reliable tradition from people who are totally acceptable, totally honest, and they saw that this was they saw that God talked to them. So as the sage and the Khuzari tells us to the king of the Khazars, the Khuzari king, the king says, well, you know, I can't deny it. We have such a reliable tradition. So obviously, this God that you believe in must have a God, must be a God with a body. Because otherwise, how would they see God? How would they hear God? So the sage says, God forbid that we should believe in something which reason rejects. In other words, reason rejects that God could have a body. Reason tells us God cannot have a body. And therefore, I can't believe in a physical God. But the king said, well, yeah, but you saw God, you heard God. So the sage says, you know what? We can explain that. And the explanation is that just as God is able to create a world out of nothing, so too, God can create voices. God can create a voice which is heard. God can create visions which are seen. And they're real visions and they're real voice. But they're not physical from God. They're just creations. Now, it's interesting when he gives this explanation in the Book of Khuzari, he's basically taking it from Rav Sadia Gaon from the 10th century, who came up with this idea in Judaism of the created voice and the created glory. But after he gives this as an explanation, he says, you know what? I don't know if this is the real explanation. I don't know for sure. And the explanations he gives, he generally backs down and says, I don't know for sure, and it's better if you just believe on the basis of tradition. But if you have to have an explanation, we can at least provide some kind of explanation. Now let's look for a minute about the proof from history, the proof of the 600,000 witnesses. There are many people who accept this proof and are very convinced that it's true and are think it's a very resounding success or a very convincing proof. But the problem is that we know the Torah is true according to Halevi, because there are 600,000 witnesses to it. But how do we know there are 600,000 witnesses? Well, we know that because it says it in the Torah. Well, how do I know that what the Torah tells me about the witnesses is true? Well, because there are 600,000 witnesses. But how do I know there are 600,000 witnesses? That's because it tells me that in the Torah. So this is a very, very circular argument. And in fact, I had a student in class once who got very upset that I had sort of said the argument is not very good, it's not a very good rational argument, it's not a convincing demonstration, since it's circular. And he suddenly said, well, how many witnesses would it take for you to accept it? Totally misunderstanding the point that I was making. Soon thereafter, he informed me that his rabbi told him he was no longer allowed to come to my class, and he dropped out. So it was too bad, but that's what happened.
I didn't understand that.
Anyway, so we have an argument which is somewhat circular, or very circular, but one that's very popular. I've heard other variations. People would say, for instance, how do you know that George Washington existed? Well, you'd answer, well, I read in the books of history. So the response to that is, well, if you believe books of history written by humans, why don't you accept the Torah written by God? Also, circular argument, but acceptable, or very many people accept it today. And one sees this historical argument from, in the traditional community, the argument from history. We know the Torah is true because of the witnesses to the giving of the Torah. Now, there are some people who try to, salvage this view and say that we know about the 600,000 witnesses not only because it's written in the Torah, but because we have an oral tradition. And this oral tradition has been passed down from Sinai. And people wouldn't make up such a tradition. But it seems to me that ultimately the only real proof of this tradition is, but not proof, of the only source of the tradition is the Torah itself. Now, if we're talking about Halevi and this historical proof, we still have to ask the question, why the Jews? Why did God make a special agreement with the Jews? Why did God reveal himself to the Jewish people, specifically came out of Egypt? Well, in order to explain this, Halevi's sage in the book talks about the different levels of existence, that there is a hierarchy, there's a chain of being. At the bottom of the chain is the natural order, which for him includes the plants, the plant life. After that, you get the psychic order, the order of the soul, and that's the level of animals. Afterwards, there's an intellectual order, and that's people. At which point, the sage says to the Kuzari, he says, well, is there anything after that? Do you think there's a level after the intellectual level? So the king, who had been speaking to a philosopher, says, well, maybe the philosophers, maybe the great sages. To it, in which the Jewish sage answers, well, yeah, but that's not really different in kind than regular human beings. But if you find a human being who can walk in fire and not be hurt, and who can go 40 days and 40 nights without eating and drinking, who can live a long life without aging, and a few other descriptions that obviously come from the story of Moses, would you think this is someone different? And the king says, well, yes, I guess so. So for Halevi, Jews have a special quality which marks them off from the rest of human beings. And this he would call the divine order, or the divine thing, or the divine influence. In Arabic, Amar Ilahi. In the Hebrew translations, usually the Inyan Elohi, the divine thing, or Advar Elohi. And according to Halevi, Jews are special because they have this special, unique quality. So how did Jews get this? And this, the sage explains in a different part of the first book of the Kuzari, when the king says to him, well, what about if you're so wonderful, why did you have the golden calf? And the sage answers, well, you know what? Because our sins are told, because our sins are recounted, we know that we're special. In any event, he has to explain, should say scientifically, why the Jewish people are different than the rest of humanity. And to explain this, he takes an idea that when Adam was created, Adam was perfect, and Adam had this special relationship with God. And notice the sort of answer, or backhanded answer to Christianity, because according to Christianity, we as humans inherited from Adam sin. For Halevi, there are people who inherited from Adam the special quality. And this special quality, which in Arabic called safwa, purity, pure character, somewhat of a purity characteristic. This was handed down from Adam, not to all his sons, to Abel, but not to Cain. And this is why, according to Halevi, Cain killed Abel, because he was fighting over this inheritance. But this is sort of almost biological. And then you had Seth, and then you had Noah, and then you had Shem, and then you had Eber, and then you got to Abraham. Interestingly enough, according to Halevi, it skipped over this quality. I said Safwa in Arabic, and Hebrew is usually translated Skula, the chosenness, passed over Abraham's father, Terach, and came to from Haran, the grandfather, to Abraham himself. And in fact, Halevi says, we often see grandchildren who look like their grandparents and not like their parents. From Abraham, it went to Isaac, but not Ishmael, and the other six children. From Isaac, it went to Jacob and not to Esau. And then from Jacob, it spread to the entire Jewish people, all his descendants. If we're talking in biological terms again, a grandchild looking like a grandfather, the grandparent, then we could say that up until Jacob, this was a recessive gene. But after Jacob, it became a dominant gene. All the people of Israel had a special quality. Now, where did Halevi come up with this idea? I mean, this sounds, I mean, modern people would call it racism, perhaps. Certainly, it's an essentialist view of Judaism. The Jews are different. Interestingly enough, the source is in Shiite Islam. Shiites were a branch, a denomination, I don't know how you'd call it, Islam, usually the minority against the Sunnis. And they believe that Adam and through Noah and then through the prophets, until Muhammad, there is one special person in each generation who had this quality. But for them, the quality never spread to the rest of the people. For the Shiites, it spread only, it arrived at the last imam. They believe that there's the seventh imam, after Muhammad, had the special quality, the Safwa, the Gula in Hebrew. And it's that imam who never died, who is hiding and will come back. So if you look at rabbinic literature, there's no biological specialness to the Jewish people. Everyone is descended from Adam. But Judah Halevi, who's often considered the most Jewish of all the Jewish philosophers, took his central idea of the specialness of the Jewish people from Islamic sources. Okay. So we now know why the Jewish people, and we know now that we have a tradition that the Torah was given in front of 600,000 adult Jewish males or Israelite males. Okay. And going back just to the golden calf, when the king says, so still you're so special. Why the golden calf? And Halevi basically sort of downplays the sin. He says that they were trying to worship God. They just violated one commandment of making an idol. If today they had built a special house of worship, which was not authorized, we'd say, no, it's not so terrible. And furthermore, according to Halevi, if you look at the number of people who were killed as a result of the incident of the golden calf, it was 3,000. If you take 3,000 out of 600,000, you have a 0.5%. So, I don't know, Halevi, who wrote Judeo-Arabic, would probably not say Nishkeferleth, but that's the implication. It's not so terrible, the golden calf. Of course, it's in direct opposition to what the Torah teaches us, but Halevi, as an apologist for the Jewish people, who's giving a defense for the despised religion, had to come up with an excuse why the golden calf could happen and why it wasn't so terrible. Okay, what about the particular commandments? So the king himself says to the sage, he says, why do you have these things like, for instance, sacrifices? And the sacrifices, it says in the Torah, or my bread, korbanit lachmi, or Reach Nichochi. These are the sweet smells. That seems to indicate that the sacrifices are intended to feed God, that God enjoys the sacrifices. So why do you have these things called sacrifices? Now, this was always a problem with, in the Middle Ages for Jews who are trying to explain sacrifice. They weren't offering sacrifice in the Middle Ages, but they lived among Christians and Muslims who said sacrifices are not a way to worship God. What kind of ideas is that you worship God? You take an animal and kill the animal and burn it. That's not a good way to worship God. And even though the Jews weren't doing it, they were praying for the restoration of the sacrifices. So this was something that was very, sensitive. But what Halevi says basically is that the sacrificial system, the sacrificial service in the temple served the purpose of maintaining and contributing harmony to the world. The service itself, all the different parts, the fats, the blood, the animals, the parts of the temple, reflected the way the world works. And when Jews in the temple performed this service, they were adding to harmony of the world. And in this world, this harmonic world in which Jews were doing these commandments, it was the fact, according to Halevi, that basically Jews were the heart of the world, that the rest of the world depends on the existence of the Jewish people for their own existence. And the problem, he says, is the heart is the organ which is the most vulnerable, but also the least vulnerable. It can be the healthiest organ. It can be the least, the sickest organ. So the king says, how can that be? So he says that if you take a heart doesn't get cancer. Heart doesn't get many diseases of the limbs. So if you have a strong heart, you could have a weak body and still go on. But on the other hand, you could have very strong muscles and everything. But if you have the heart is not working, then the body will not survive. So the same way, he says, the world depends on Jews, and we need Jews for the world to work, and Jews suffer for the sins of the rest of the world. Going to the quoting from the passage in the second part of the book of Isaiah about the suffering servant of the Lord, some of the Christians take as referring to their Messiah. Okay. Again, I said before when he explained how revelation was possible from an immutable, incorporeal God, he said, maybe it's not the case. And the same thing when he explained the sacrifices, he said, much better that we accept it as true, whether we accept it as this is God's will, without trying to explain it. So Halevi says, maybe the explanation is correct, maybe it isn't. But in general, when talking about the commandments, Halevi adopts a distinction which had been brought into Judaism by Saadia Gaon, I mentioned before, between what are called mitzvot sichliot, rational commandments, and mitzvot shimiot, revelational commandments. Commandments that we hadn't heard them. Nishmoa, if we hadn't heard them, we wouldn't know they existed. So for instance, for Saadia, intellect tells us we're not allowed to murder. Intellect tells us we're not allowed to steal. But intellect will never tell us that it's permissible to eat cow, but forbidden to eat pigs. But if we look at Saadia's explanation of the commandments and his division of the commandments into the rational and the revelational commandments, we see that one could really understand that for Saadia, the rational commandments are the important ones. The revelational commandments are there in order to earn merit points, as it were. Okay? That if you observe the commandments, you accumulate merits. And at the end of life, if you have more merits than demerits, you'll have reward in the world to come. We'll talk about that next week. So the other commandments, even though there's certain value to observing these revelational commandments, they're not really the most important ones. They're just for a way of accumulating points. But for Halevi, it's the opposite. For Halevi says that no, anybody can observe the rational commandments. Even a gang of thieves observes the rational commandments among themselves, the honor among thieves, at least maybe there wasn't his day. But only Jews can observe the revelational commandments, or he calls the divine commandments. These commandments make Jewish people special, and were given to the Jewish people because the Jewish people are special. So we have a very, as I said, an essentialist view of the difference between Jews and everybody else, expressed in physically, biologically, Jews are different. In fact, converts can never achieve prophecy. Converts can never be equal to native-born Jews. The prophecy is only in the land of Israel, and I won't go into how that happened, but because obviously some of the prophets were not in Israel, but he explains how there's prophecy even outside it. But generally, as a rule of thumb, prophecy is in the land of Israel. When the temple is there and the visible Shekhinah, God's presence is there, and they all work together to explain how prophecy is possible and how it happens, tied together, as I said, by the witnessing, the 600,000 witnesses, and witnesses to other prophets. And if you ask about the other religions, Christianity and Islam, I think the first answer would be they were given not to a large group. They didn't suddenly appear on the scene of history as Judaism did. Judaism appeared at once miraculously at Mount Sinai, but Christianity took a long time to spread. So did Islam. Started with individuals and they spread slowly. So this is not a divine religion, but a man-made religion for Halevi. Okay. Let me go to Maimonides, because there's a totally different world with Maimonides. So, let me start out with the nature of the Jewish people. I often use the analogy that the difference between Maimonides and Judah Halevi when it comes to the people of Israel, excuse me, or the Jewish people, is that for Judah Halevi, being Jewish is part of one's hardware, and for Maimonides, being Jewish is part of one's software. What I mean by that is if you take a baby and you program that baby to be Jewish, whether the baby has Jewish genes or not, that baby will be Jewish. If you take the same baby, let's say has Jewish genes, but programs the baby to be non-Jewish, then in essence, this person who grows up is not Jewish, doesn't have the rules that refer to him as a Jew. The technical term is tinok shenishpa. This is a baby that has been captured and raised by non-Jews. So for Halevi, if you take a non-Jew and program him or her to be a Jew, they'll be a convert, but they won't be a real Jew. They won't be a native-born Jew. They won't have this special quality. On the other hand, you take a biological Jew and raise them non-Jewish, they'll still have the special quality of being Jewish. So if you may be familiar, there is a British journalist who penned the ditty, "How odd of God to choose the Jews," to which a number of answers, one of which is not so odd, they chose God. So if you look at Maimonides, basically what he says is it's Abraham who chose God. Abraham discovered God. And because Abraham discovered God, God had a special relationship with Abraham and then with Abraham's descendants. So Jews are special because of their relationship to God, not they have a relationship to God because they're special as Halevi saw it. In fact, it's interesting for Maimonides, a convert is, from what he writes, is more a Jew than a biological Jew. There is a a convert, apparently from Islam, who wrote to Maimonides, Ovadia the Hager, Ovadia the proselyte, who asked whether he could say certain things in the prayer book, like Eloheinu v'Elohei Avoteinu, our God and God of our fathers. He said, I'm not physically descended from Abraham. And Maimonides says, no, but you're spiritually descended from Abraham. This is more important than being a physical descendant of Abraham. You, more than anybody, can claim Abraham as your patriarch, as your parents. All right, so if you have this position that Jews are not biologically special or not physically special or not set off from the rest of humanity, in order for God to be revealed to somebody, people, it has to be because of their qualities and not because of their preparation, because of their intellect, because of their spirituality, because they discover God and not because God comes and finds them and picks them out special. So for Maimonides, in order for a person to be a prophet, the person has to have certain personal qualities, has to be learned, has to be, for Maimonides, a philosopher. And to be a philosopher, when, according to Maimonides, one else must have to be moral. But being moral is not sufficient. One has to have moral qualities and intellectual qualities. And then it's not that God picks that person out. It's not that God says to them one bright day, like we have, as the Bible seems to indicate, when he comes to Jeremiah and says, I knew you, even before you were born, I knew you. Or Isaiah, that suddenly sees God and God says, who am I going to send? And Isaiah says, well, here I am, I'm ready. According to Maimonides, the prophet is the one who has to discover God. And once a prophet has to discover God, it's a question of not God's actively revealing himself to the prophet, but the prophet intuits what God wants to bring, what's the message God has for the people. So he comes up with a very rationalistic explanation of the of prophecy. I'm not going into all the details. It has to do with medieval psychology and medieval cosmology, the nature of the world, God's constant emanation of sort of it's like, you could say it's like radio waves that you have to turn the radio on the right channel, or maybe today we'd say it's Wi-Fi that you have to be to log into it. So the prophecy is something that comes from humans toward God and not from God towards human, and that solves the problem of why particular people are chosen. Particular people aren't chosen. They choose themselves in a sense. And how is it that they see visions and they hear voices? Well, for Maimonides, it's because they have very vivid imaginations. These are things they see in dreams, or this is visions that they're able to use their imagination. Not that God has a voice, not that God is seeing anything, not that God can be seen, not that God can talk with vocal cords. And how does that work with Moses? Moses gave a Torah, and according to Maimonides, is the only one who gave a Torah. It's the only one who gave legislation. According to Maimonides, Moses was a totally unique individual. You can't even call him a prophet. He was like a super prophet, but his prophecy was different than the prophets of others. And he was the only one who gave the Torah. Now, there's an interesting issue as to what the purpose of the other prophets. Now, sometimes in the Talmud, for instance, we see that rules, part of the halakha, is derived from the books of the prophets. In other words, they'll use verses from the prophets to justify a particular halakha. But Maimonides says that the prophets are not allowed to teach halakha. If a prophet comes and says, God told me the halakha is this way, then this is a capital offense, according to Maimonides. The other prophets can only preach to the people, try to get them to behave themselves. But in terms of halakha, this is given over to humans. Lo b'shamayim, it's not in the heavens. Those of you know the story of the oven of Achnai and how the argument among the rabbis. So Maimonides takes a very naturalistic, very human view of prophecy, of revelation, and of Jewish law. And why that Jewish law? Why those particular commandments? According to Maimonides, the commandments don't reflect the cosmos. They don't reflect God. There's a term called theurgy, that if you do something, what humans do affects what God, that happens with God. That's called theurgy, which for Halevi certainly is the case, but for Maimonides not. So why these commandments? According to Maimonides, they're to bring human perfection so that one can achieve, we'll see next week, in terms of life after death, by perfecting the intellect. And how is that done? Well, first of all, by having good societal laws. If you live in a society where people are harming each other, where people are killing each other, where they're stealing, where they don't, there's no justice, one isn't going to have a lot of time to develop one's intellect. So you have those societal rules that keep the world going well. You also have laws which promote the correct beliefs, so that when the Torah prohibits idolatry, it's so that one will know that God is one and there's only one God, the God of Israel. So that's what the Torah is doing, is promoting truth, true beliefs. But what about, like, for instance, the sacrifices? I mentioned for Halevi, they reflected the world. We also have others who said that God commanded the sacrifices because by bringing an animal, killing the animal, the person who brings the sacrifice understands that he or she is mortal. He or she is going to die, and therefore it's necessary to repent before death. And there are other explanations of giving. Maimonides has a very interesting explanation. He said, when the people of Israel came out of Egypt, if Moses had said to the people, you know what, we're not going to offer sacrifices, they wouldn't have been able to accept it. This was something that people needed. It was part of the way religion is run. So God couldn't get rid of sacrifices, or God through Moses couldn't get rid of sacrifices, but the commandments are not every animal, only certain animals, not every place in the world, but only the one place, the temple, not everybody could offer the sacrifices, only the priests, not everyone can come into the temple, only those who are ritually pure. So the sacrifices were limited. They weren't eliminated, but they were limited. And Maimonides said it was like today, if someone were to come to a synagogue today and say, you know what, God told me that you shouldn't pray. Throughout the prayer book, we should sit around and meditate. Well, that prophet wouldn't get very far in a synagogue today. So same thing he said in the times of Moses, and Moses had come and said no more sacrifices, that wouldn't have worked either. So here you have the exact opposite from Halevi. Halevi, who says there's something intrinsically valuable in the sacrifices, and Maimonides says the sacrifices are a concession to human weakness. Now, please remember that according to Maimonides, when the Messiah comes, the sacrifices will be resumed. They'll be reinstituted. So it's not like Maimonides is saying, oh, great, the temple was destroyed, now we don't have to have sacrifices. He's saying, no, the sacrifices were given for historical reasons, but once they were given, they're part of the law and they'll be renewed. Okay. How do we know the Torah is true? Halevi, as I said, gave an historical explanation that we had 600,000 people who witnessed it, and therefore the origin is from God. For Maimonides, every legal system is divine, because every legal system is part of the human providence, that humans as political animals, as social animals, need a society with its laws. And therefore, the laws of the city ordinances of Toronto are divine, just like the Torah is divine. What's the difference between the city ordinances in Toronto, the ones that say you can cross the street on green and have to stop in red, or the speed limits? The difference is that in a human legal system, what we consider a human legal system, the purpose of the law is to maintain societal well-being, is to do health and welfare of the citizens. In a divine law, in addition to these things, the laws promote individual intellectual perfection. So you won't get to heaven by not crossing the road, the street on a red light, but you will get to heaven. I'm using this term loosely, getting to heaven, we'll talk about it next week, by observing the laws of the Torah. And as I said, some of them are to deny idolatry. Many of the laws, according to Maimonides, were promulgated because the idolaters were doing similar things at that time. So the Torah says, don't do those activities. And the Torah leads us toward correct beliefs. So for Maimonides, this is what makes the Torah the divine. This is what proves the Torah is correct. And he adds another thing along with that, which is that the person who gives the Torah, the person who gives a divine law, a divine religion, has to be a moral person. And for Maimonides, morality is tied up especially to denial of the senses of the physical body. And he basically says that the divine lawgiver has to be celibate, has to not have wife. So, of course, Moses had a wife, but according to the Midrash, when he became a prophet, they separated. And Maimonides doesn't say this explicitly, but it's obviously the case. He's talking about Muhammad, who had multiple wives. So Islam can't be true because the prophet was not a person who controlled his senses, his appetites. Christianity isn't true because it teaches things about God which are false. But Judaism is true because of the contents. So you might want to think, and today I mentioned that today, if you look in the traditional community, usually the proof of the divinity of the Torah has to do with history and the witnesses. But perhaps that paradigm is wrong. Perhaps the paradigm that one should adopt is that the nature of the Torah, the contents of the Torah, shows its divinity and not the historical circumstances, which themselves can't be proven. In terms of Christianity and Islam, Maimonides says something which is very similar to what Halevi said, which is they are precursors for the Messiah. Maimonides says explicitly in the Mishneh Torah, the laws of the kings, that because Islam and Christianity spread the nature, the notion of a Messiah, when the Messiah comes, people will understand, will recognize him as the Messiah. And Halevi says something somewhat similar. So they're not true religions, but they are religions which are part of the divine plan of spreading Judaism, as it were. All right. Another interesting issue is the issue of the Hebrew language. For Halevi, the Hebrew language was intrinsic to the prophetic process. The world was created with Hebrew. The first language before the Tower of Babel was the Hebrew language. And the Hebrew language is intrinsically holy. When Maimonides deals with the question, why is the Hebrew language considered the Lashon Kodesh, the holy language? He says, because there are no vulgar words in the language. There are no words in Hebrew which are specific to certain bodily functions, which we usually don't talk about or talk about euphemistically. All right? Hebrew doesn't have those words. Now, it's probably not true what he's saying, but what he's trying to say is that there's nothing intrinsically valuable in the Hebrew language as such. Notice, by the way, that Halevi, who's writing a book defending the superiority of the Jewish people and the land of Israel and Jewish commandments and the Hebrew language, wrote this book in Arabic because he was incapable of writing in Hebrew in his own day. And he says it in the Kuzari that in his day, the language had deteriorated, as did the people. The fate of the people of Israel determined the fate of the language of Hebrew. But Maimonides says nothing really special about Hebrew except these lack of vulgarities. And as my friend Menachem Kellner, University of Haifa, likes to say, if Abraham had been a Navajo, the Torah would have been given in the Navajo language and not in the Hebrew language, according to Maimonides. Nothing special about Hebrew, nothing holy, intrinsically holy. Okay, why is there no prophecy today? Well, for Halevi, this is a pretty easy way of answering. There's a pretty easy answer, which is if you need prophecy to be in the land of Israel when the visible Shekhinah, God's presence, is there, and one has to be observing the commandments correctly, which includes the sacrificial system in the temple, without these preconditions, there can't be prophecy today. Presumably, when the Messiah comes and the temple is rebuilt, again, there'll be prophecy as there was at the time of the Bible. Maimonides, however, since prophecy is a natural quality of certain special individuals, says in our own day, it's very difficult to prepare oneself for prophecy. We live in a time of sadness. We live in a time of exile. We live in a time of Jewish lack of success. And therefore, for someone to overcome these conditions and prepare himself for prophecy is too much in our time. It's interesting, there's a very clever article by Professor Abraham Joshua Heschel, who's known more for his own creative Jewish thinking than his research, wrote an interesting article about Maimonides, arguing that Maimonides thought that he himself had reached the level of prophecy. Somewhat of a controversial article, but it's a very clever article. And there are those after Maimonides who try to reintroduce actual rabbinic ordination, real rabbinic ordination, and try to reestablish the community in the land of Israel and lead to prophecy. But if one asks, as many people do, well, if God talked to people in the past, why doesn't God talk to people now? So both Halevi and Maimonides and other Jewish thinkers came up with reasons why we no longer have prophecy, but an expectation that prophecy would be renewed in the Messianic period. So I guess the Messianic period already, we're talking about reward and punishment, afterlife, the problem of evil, and the way the world runs, and that we're going to leave for next week. So, if there are any questions, I'd be happy to take them. No, there were no chatters today. If anybody wants to put anything into chat?
Anybody wants to orally speak up, please feel free to do so.
Hi. Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Hello, Rabbi Jay. I'm the person who just posted in chat. I might have misunderstood what you said, but Ibn Ezra, who was born in the same town as Yehuda Levi, slightly younger, he wrote in Hebrew and not just the poetry. So I don't understand how Yehuda Levi couldn't have, unless I misunderstood what you said.
Okay, so that's a very interesting question. Thank you. In 1140, when Judah Halevi left for the land of Israel with his son-in-law, who might have been that he might have been Ibn Ezra's son-in-law, it's unclear. At the same time as Halevi was leaving Spain, Iberia, for the land of Israel, Abraham Ibn Ezra was leaving Iberia for Europe. He went to Rome and he went to France, went to England. He traveled around Europe. Because the people living there could not speak Arabic, he had to write in Hebrew. And What he did was he invented his own vocabulary, scientific and philosophical vocabulary, which he used, which he has in his both in his commentaries on the Torah, on the Bible, and in his scientific writings. If you read these writings, you'll see they're very difficult to understand because his Hebrew was different than our Hebrew. And why is our Hebrew the way it is? Because the translators, the family of translators, Ibn Tibbon family, Judah Ibn Tibbon translated the Kuzari, and Samuel Ibn Tibbon, who translated the guide, Maimonides' guide, they invented a vocabulary which stuck. That was the scientific vocabulary which was accepted. So Ibn Ezra wrote in Hebrew by making up his own words, and they weren't, it never made a great impact on the Hebrew language. A older contemporary of both Ibn Ezra and Judah Halevi was Avram Barchia, who basically did the same thing as Abraham Israel. He moved from Arabic-speaking Iberia to southern France, where they spoke Hebrew, and he realized there are no books in Hebrew from which one could study science, geography, astronomy, or other sciences, mathematics. So he wrote books in Hebrew and did very much like Ibn Ezra. He created his own vocabulary. So I see there's a question about the Rambam's Mishneh Torah that he wrote in Hebrew. One could argue the foundation of modern Hebrew is the language of the Yad. Well, that's true because language of the Yad HaZakar, the Mishneh Torah, is rabbinic Hebrew. It's the language of Chazal. It's the language of the Mishnah. And he was very careful to write in this very pure Mishnaic rabbinic Hebrew. And therefore, it's very understandable for us today because that's one of the bases of modern Hebrew. It's interesting. Someone wrote to the Rambam once and asked him if he would translate the Yad HaZakah, the Mishnah Torah, into Arabic. And Maimonides wrote back and said, no, it's such simple, easy Hebrew. You should learn the Hebrew to be able to understand it. There's no reason to translate it. And there's a scholar of medieval Jewish philosophy, Abraham Nouriel, blessed in memory, who used to say that he regretted that Rambam didn't write the Mishnah Torah in Arabic because then he would have understood him. And by writing in Hebrew, there are a number of terms the Rambam uses that he couldn't understand because he wasn't sure what the Rambam was saying. And it's interesting. Here's another interesting thing about Hebrew language. Maimonides' scientific Hebrew in the Mishneh Torah is different than Ibn Tibbon, his translator's Hebrew for the guide. So, for instance, the word matter, as opposed to a matter and form. So Rambam uses the term in Hebrew golem, which we know is from the golem of Prague, but it was a good Hebrew word. And Ibn Tibbon used the word chomer. Well, chomer stuck, golem didn't. And a number of other examples like that, where in the Hebrew translation of Maimonides' guide, the translator did not use Hebrew terms that Maimonides had used for the same ideas in the Mishneh Torah. So Hebrew certainly has a long history, and but the question as to whether or not there's something intrinsically superior in Hebrew language, which is the claim of Judah Halevi, this is something which Maimonides didn't agree. I see there's a hand up. How's this work?
Yes, go ahead.
All right, so you talked about the content 20 or 25 minutes ago. So the content of the Torah is true, and the content of certain other revelations or claimed revelations isn't true. But as you're just pointing out about translations, going from the content to the actuality via the means of the rabbis might not necessarily be true. And I'll give you an example that today people would be very uncomfortable with. the fact that Aliyah LeRegel for Jerusalem, that the lame would be excluded from giving sacrifices because they can't make it up the hill on their own power, today it horrifies people. And we would say that the way we treat people, in quotes, at the margins of society, the lame, the blind, shows the truthfulness of something, and the rabbis excluded them. So we today, by that basis, would have often much trouble with the Torah because of those kind of interpretations. Your thoughts on that?
Yeah, okay. What I was saying is that the historical proof of Judah Halevi, to my mind, is a circular argument and is not one that's going to convince people who are not already believers. It's interesting. Some of you may know that a number of years ago, someone came up with Torah codes that claim that this was a proof of the divinity of the Torah, the fact that you can have all kinds of secrets by counting letters and coming up with the other words. What I'm saying is the truth, what my mind is in terms of the truth of the Torah, is the question is whether it's a divine law system. And from his point of view, the divine law system is one which leads one to perfection. Now, I'm sure that everyone, including the most observant people, can find particular commandments that bother them or upset them or are more difficult to observe. Maimonides himself, in a very famous passage in the Guide, says the Torah, like nature, takes into account the majority of people. In other words, the laws of the Torah could be bad for a particular person, just like the laws of nature could be bad for a particular person. So he was aware of the fact that not everyone could get total value, total worth out of the Torah, because any law system has to take into account the majority of people and not the small minority. In terms of the specific example that you gave, given the ability to continue to develop halakha and to interpret the halakha, which the Rambam thought was a very human activity and not something was laid down at Sinai, all the details, I would assume that the Rambam would argue that when the temple is rebuilt, there will be accommodations for people who have the physical disabilities. One could ask, what does a vegetarian do when it comes to the Paschal sacrifice? I heard a story that the Beit Din that had a vegetarian wanted to convert, and they said, what would you do when the temple is rebuilt with it? And the Paschal sacrifice, Korban Pesach, he said, well, I wouldn't be able to eat it, and they wouldn't let him convert because he wasn't willing to accept all the commandments. All right, someone asked me, aren't you downplaying the role of Masorah tradition in our belief in Jewish existence? So the term Lashon Kodesh is modern. Well, no. The use of the term as a holy language for Hebrew is not modern. Maimonides specifically mentions it, but he says the holiness has to do with its vocabulary and not with its intrinsic value. In terms of the Masorah tradition, I don't know if I'm downplaying it. I'm trying to show how our Jewish thinkers over the years answered the questions concerning the philosophical challenges to the tradition, how the philosophical challenges to the claims of revelation and prophecy and last week, the existence of God and creation. Next week, reward and punishment, the problem of evil. So the tradition is part of the Jewish beliefs that the philosophers are trying to defend. It is interesting, though, that in Maimonides' Guide of the Perplexed, when he explains the commandments of the Torah, he explains them what he figures is the literal meaning of them, like almost a Karaite version of some of the commandments, and says he's not interested in talking about the Torah Shabbat Peh at this time. Okay, a number of people are saying thank you, and I see we're past the 2:00 mark. So
I was going to tell you, interesting, Danny Sperber, when he was here, I asked him what he's a vegetarian. And yeah. I asked him what he would do when they, you know, build the Beit HaMikdash. So he said he'd have a kazayit of Korban Pesach. What can he do? The Torah says you have to have to lead exactly a kazayit, and that would be it. So, I mean, it's interesting. But, yeah, anyways, because, okay. Thank you very much. We look forward
to they would accept him as a convert.
Yeah, although maybe for other reasons they wouldn't. I won't go there. As you know, people in Torah Moshe, we like him very much. He's really a tremendous Talmid Chacham, a tremendous scholar. But, you know, he's not afraid to take positions that not everybody agrees with. Let's just put it that way for now. But anyway.
Okay, we'll see everybody next week.
Thank you very much. This evening, Rabbi Dr. Benji Samuels from Newton, Massachusetts, will be giving our Parsha Shiur. And then tomorrow morning, 9:30, those who want to come, my Siddur Shiur. And all are welcome. All are welcome to all our Shiurim. And so are all your friends. So please invite them to come along. Next week, in addition to all our regular Shiurim, we will, Shuli Mishkan will be starting a new series Monday. So register for that. And we look forward to seeing you. And Dr. Lasker, enjoy. And everybody be well. We hope to see you all soon. Thank you very much. Have a great day. Bye-bye, everybody.